So I'm Indib, faculty at the School of Biology at Georgia Tech, and joint appointment with the School of Mathematics. And I'm really had a great pleasure to come here because my original background is in physics. I used to be a student at Moscow Institute for Physics and Technology. I studied physics with Evgeny Lifshitz. You know, you should know the name of Lifshitz and Landau. And also I was a student at, actually, Landau Institute for Theoretical Physics and Kapitsa Institute of Problems in Physics. So this was a way how Russian physicists were educated, not only in the basic institute, but in research institutes. So we had some time to go and meet leading scientists, leading physicists. So I think this year was the best years of my studies. And let's see, in 85, I moved to Institute for Molecular Genetics, which basically was affiliated with Institute of Atomic Physics for some strange reasons. It's a whole story why. In this institute, we started to develop something like NCBI, Russian NCBI, which was also a database and a theoretical group which studied sequences. So it would take a really long time to use historical approach. At the moment, I will jump to the topic of the lecture, which is gene identification with help of Markov models. And I was asked to give a brief introduction to explain what this problem is. And this problem is as follows. So you have DNA and some fragments of DNA. This is one strand, let's say 5 prime, 3 prime. It goes for thousands of nucleotides. Somewhere in DNA sequence, there are genes. Or protein coding regions. We're talking about protein coding regions. But there are also genes for rRNAs and tRNAs. And maybe something yet unknown, but we are talking about protein coding regions only. So if I talk about prokaryotes, then gene structure is like that. So to magnify it would be a sequence which can be divided into codons. And first codon in prokaryotes is usually ATG, or in some percentage of cases, it can be GTG, or sometimes even TTG. But this takes about 90% of cases. Then the sequence of codons goes on and on and on, sometimes for thousands of nucleotides. An average size of a coding region in a prokaryote is about 900 nucleotides. And in the end, so if you read it in triplets without interruption, you reach a triplet which is going to be TAA or TAG or TGA, which is a stop codon. So at this point, process of translation stops. I skip here the phase of transcription of DNA sequence into mRNA. So in general speaking, here is two-step process. First you go to mRNA, which is a copy of this part of a gene with some small extras. in front and in the end, and mRNA is actually translated by rules of genetic code into sequence of amino acids and makes a folded structure eventually of the protein molecule. So this is one particular way of organization of genes. Another way, if you talk about prokaryotic, here is prokaryotic, eukaryotic, then this picture is more complicated. So what is going on? That when you get a mRNA copy, this mRNA copy, not directly translated, it has some regions called introns, which actually are those regions inside gene sequence. And of course, you can map them back to original DNA. Introns are spliced out in the process of RNA splicing. So you get, after RNA splicing, a shorter mRNA, which actually looks like prokaryotic one, which is continuous, and which, again, has the same structure. The only notable exception is that only ATG is used in eukaryotes. And this is basically it. So same stop codons are used in eukaryotes as well, up to human. And let's see. The problem of gene finding in eukaryotes in this way is aggravated by presence of these non-coding regions inside a gene. So again, in front of the gene, you have, as well as here, non-translated regions, and their general designations are 5' untranslated region and 3' untranslated region. So these pieces here and there. So they appear on the level of transcription. So they are transcribed but not translated. Similarly to introns, they are transcribed but not translated. Okay, so this is prokaryotic. And basically, the problem which people who do gene finding have to address, they have to actually parse DNA sequence into coding and non-coding regions. And in coding regions, not only this quite I would say easy signals present, like stop codon or start codon. The whole coding region, if it is read in triplets, should provide you with amino acid sequence according to well-known rules of the genetic code, right? The only problem is when you have anonymous DNA sequence, you have difficulty to start reading it from a particular nucleotide and read in triplets. And you even don't know whether your coding region is on direct strand or it is on complementary strand. So there is another factor of uncertainty. Let's see. There are some extra mechanisms that may help to find start of coring region, which are related to mechanisms of transcription and translation. So when you start transcription, some complicated machinery has to bind to DNA and start this transcription. I just to give you an impression about complexity of this mechanism, this is a picture which shows that this is promoter region. So it requires a whole number of specialized proteins to position this green complex near such a transcription initiation site with help of proteins that make tricky three-dimensional structure. So it is a not a very well defined problem when you try to find determinants of promoter sequences. So this is one extra problem which may be solved within the whole scope of gene finding, or can be considered as a separate problem. Another thing is that near boundaries of introns, these parts somehow should be found by cell to splice out, and those parts which are left, they carry genetic code, the exons. So cell somehow finds these boundaries, and here is another picture which indicates position frequency patterns near boundary of intron and exon. Red is exon, and then here is intron, and then again boundary with exon. So these are called donor acceptor sites, and for now just you can think that larger letters represent larger frequencies of these particular nucleotides in specific positions around these boundaries. And yes, I will address this question. And the other similar situation is observed in prokaryotic case, when obviously we don't have acceptor splice, acceptor and donor splice here, splice sites here. But on mRNA, there is a region where a ribosome binds before translation starts. And this particular region also has a particular position frequency pattern. And this region is not located precisely on a certain distance. This is a distribution of a length between the start of a gene and such a position frequency biased region, which corresponds to ribosomal binding site. So, just to say what is a complicated thing in finding prokaryotic genes, it's a fact, it's the possibility that prokaryotic genes, they may slightly overlap with each other. So this is a rather rare case in eukaryotic genes. And actually, coding regions never overlap in eukaryotic genes. You may find genes sometimes inside introns of some other gene. So this is other sort of overlap. But in prokaryotes, this this is rather frequent case when genes overlap in their start or end regions. And this is actually a picture which indicates them. Characteristics of overlaps. For instance, on the same strand, if we consider overlaps of genes that are located on the same strand. There are frequent overlaps in one of four nucleotides, relatively very small overlaps, but also present overlaps of longer. Of course, you don't see overlaps which are multiple of three, because otherwise the stop codon of the preceding gene will immediately disrupt the second gene. And on the opposite strand, there are also possibility when genes can overlap end to end, and rarely start to start, very rare.
But aren't there overlaps of length 2, or 5, or I mean, that seems like a star pattern, like 1 and 4 and 7.
No, one, for instance, 4 is a case when you have overlap when this is the start of a gene, okay, ADG, but this is the end of the preceding gene. So this is the overlap of 4, which is quite frequent. The restriction in terms of amino acids, I didn't study specifically, for instance, because if you talk about N-terminal that start the protein, so there are some preferences for, say, non-structured regions. You wouldn't start immediately with alpha helix or beta sheet. Is some preference for amino acids composition in the beginning of the gene. And this sample is, in general, quite small. And you don't have much of statistical material to figure out if there is a strong composition bias. We observe some bias, but not strong compositional bias in terms of amino acids, which are in overlapping regions. So here we come, according to your question, to some interesting problem. So how we are going to do gene finding, do identification of protein coding regions. And I should say that at the beginning, what would you think about the approach is something which has been known quite for some time, and it goes back to cryptology. So in cryptology, when people wanted to make their meaning of their message hidden to somebody else, they used to cipher letters that they used the normal alphabet into some other letters by a certain rule, and then the message was quite cryptic, what it is. And the first idea how to decipher the messages was to use letter frequencies. This idea is back 1,000 years ago and was suggested by Arabs who invented algebra, but most dramatic use of that approach was when Queen Mary from Scotland, she had communication with her friends using such a cryptic language. But in Queen Elizabeth's, in her court, there were predecessors of current FBI agents, and they were quite smart, and they found the approach exactly that. Having a priori knowledge that the message is written in English, so they knew which letters are most frequent in English language, and they were able to decipher all these messages. And this was the most significant evidence when Queen Mary was sentenced to death, that she had a coup and she wanted to eliminate Elizabeth. So when I started to work with DNA sequences, we actually used on the same approach. We used frequency approach, and so general idea is that you have a statistical model which generates sequence. It may generate sequence with some probabilities, P1, or let's say PT, PC, PA, PG. So you have model 1, and then you have model 2, and here is, let's say, assumption. Now what we have to do, we have to decipher in a continuous sequence, nucleotide sequence, situation is that part of this sequence is written in one language, another part is written in another language. So we can also use frequencies of the observed letters, which correspond to probabilities of our models, in order to decide to which particular functional region this or that fragment belongs to. So let's say if I have a probability, a segment, which is a sequence of nucleotides, x1, xn, and I have my models, so I will have a probability of S under condition that I use model P, and I have probability of S under condition I use model 2. So these are quantities which can be computed by standard formulas. This is multinomial model. So what you do, you multiply, let's say, either taken from model 1, 1 to n, this is one term, or another one is product of 2. Xi here. So what we can do, we can find these probabilities having such models, and eventually we can do a likelihood ratio of S and further down, you can do likelihood ratio and study what this would happen. And unfortunately, here, the analogy with cryptology is coming to an end. We have to do something else. Still, if you... Yes? It's a upper-script index. It's not square. It's model 2, if you wish. And model 1. Model 1, model 2. The most simplest model. Most simplest models. So, well, if I do just one step, one more step, which just for connection with previous lectures, I would say here, when you take a likelihood ratio, so this is L, and if you take log likelihood ratio. So asymptotically, if n is very long, what you get is And you get the following thing. You get sum of pi. So this asymptotic expression can be written in both in two cases, either on the assumption that the sequence is described by model 1 or assumption that sequence is described by model 2. If it is described by model 1, then frequencies of nucleotides will, let's say frequency p will be asymptotically npt1, right? So in such a product, you will see, let me not to skip the steps here, logarithm of the product of a probability of x npx. So assumption is this is model 1. Down here will be probability of x nucleotide np1x. It's still np1x because we work on this that sequence. And here, if you take logarithm of products, you get the sum of npx1 logarithm of px1 over px2. And then here is a quantity which is proportional to the length of the sequence. So basically, the if you normalize it to the length of the sequence, then you get px1 which is Kalbach-Leibler distance for these two distributions. And actually, this result is important for theoretical estimations of how accurately you can discriminate between two sequences. And just a remark is that Kalbach, as a matter of fact, also was involved in cryptology. So he actually worked in a team who cracked Japanese Navy code in World War II. So just such a coincidence. Then, in the next step, so what I'd like to do, I'd like to find such models which would give me largest Kalbach-Leibler distance. So the larger it is, the better my potential for discrimination between coding and non-coding regions. And here is the illustration how to get to better models. This is as follows. Okay, so what is this picture? Instead of counting frequencies of nucleotides horizontally, like in coding region and non-coding region, what I do, I'm going to count these frequencies vertically, if you wish. What does it mean? It means I would do multiple alignment of sequences that code for a gene, and then we'll see if there are patterns that can be detected by this multiple alignment. So what I do, I take a sequence which has non-coding region on the left from start codon, here ATG, and then here is coding region. Okay? And at a certain stage of sequencing let's say, Human Genome Project, there were enough sequences with known, presumably known starts in bacterial genomes that you can get quite a number of such sequences, align them against the start, ATG start, and see what happens. So what frequencies we'll observe in each position if we numerate it from 0, plus 1, and so on, minus 1, and so on. So we just show here the result of this observation. The whole length here is 100%. So, and each nucleotide frequency is shown on top of each other. So this is in total will be 1.0 or 100%. This small thing, at that time when we did it, some sequences were not complete, so we couldn't get the whole non-coding sequence, so we just unknown. Yes?
Let me ask you something about the feature on top.
Yes.
Is it a necessary and sufficient condition for a gene to start with this and end with this? In other words, you cannot have an ATG in the middle of the gene, and you cannot have a TAA also. I mean, it has to start with one of these, has to end. But what happened in the middle?
I think
these
it's a necessary but not sufficient condition. It's so just you can have ATG inside. You have ATG inside. It can be. As far as starts are concerned, as far as ends are concerned, you cannot have it inside stop codon.
So inside, there's no way to have TAA, TAG, or TTA.
No way if you talk about in-frame triplets. They are read in-frame, three and three. So if you consider the sequence of triplets, there is no stop codon inside here. But it may be these inside. This, yeah.
So the end is a necessary implication, but not the beginning.
Not the beginning. Yeah. In prokaryotes, in prokaryotes. In eukaryotes, same thing. The only thing is that in the beginning you also you have always that. That's. So if I come back to this picture, then what you see here is in non-coding regions on the left, the pattern of positional frequencies you see quite a random one, which. Fluctuates at above certain average level for each nucleotide, then you have some fluctuation in the region which corresponded to this ribosomal binding site, and this large number of purines, which are A's and G's, or A's and G's here. And as soon as you move to coding region, so this wavy lines represent this ATG start, which almost 100% T and G here. You see this blue and yellow line. And then here you see something which is you consider bottom part, you clearly see a three periodic pattern here. And here's deviation in start area, which I mentioned about the composition of proteins in amino acids, composition in very close to proximal to protein start is biased a little bit. So in terms of numbers, what I have shown can be represented by these tables. So basically what we have that TC, A, and G, if we have this three-periodic pattern, it can be described as variability of frequencies of nucleotides in three positions of codons, right? So first position, second and third position of codon. Then in non-coding region, these levels around which they fluctuate, the frequencies, represented just by four numbers. And I didn't say what this is yet, and I'll tell it in a second. And such a pattern.
Sorry, the strange fluidity of it looks very similar to the coordinate.
Excuse me.
Frame 2.
In general, there is no such a similarity between in either one of the frames in two non-coding region. It really, there are under certain pressure, evolutionary pressure, these nucleotides in codon positions, and we never were able to prove that one of these columns, if you consider different species, and let me show you, by the way, how these frequencies change. If you consider species with different GC composition, the situation is that third position of a codon is very sensitive to general composition. For instance, you have general T composition. So this is how third position of a codon changes, frequency of T. And here is position 2 and position 1. So but from what you said, this should correspond, let's say, to global T composition. So it should be on a particular straight line, and it does not. So that's the answer to your question in some sense. Yes? Well, in the first approximation, we can talk about non-coding regions, including introns, intergenic regions, and introns considered as non-coding. So here are just interestingly that different nucleotides, they exhibit different patterns how they change with regard to global composition in different genomes.
This would seem predictable. That you would have the third position be the one that's most dependent on composition, because it's the one that matters the least in terms of resolving the amounts.
Yes. We were not surprised by the graph. It just shows how it changes. And what is next? So I didn't explain what was the coding region shadow, which was another table of positional frequencies. And this is as follows. When we have to detect genes, obviously we not only make discrimination between coding and non-coding region when we go on one strand, but as far as you get into a region which is complementary to a gene that actually is located on the complementary strand, then you can expect that the pattern of nucleotide ordering will be different from those you observe in gene or in coding region, right? So this is the third type of a pattern that you have to deal with when you do analysis of DNA sequences.
For overlapping the genes, then of course the shadow can come into the gene itself.
Yes. If we talk about overlapping genes, then you have to be careful because it's yet another pattern. And so far, I sort of giving a tutorial, if you wish, so I don't jump to all the complicated questions at once. So this is how you can describe what is going on in step by step, how you analyze the sequences. So next step is to put all these things together, so to combine models of gene shadow, position frequency models, and non-coding region into algorithm which would give you some predictions where genes are. And still I will simplify this problem at the moment by first solving the problem, which is, let's say I'm given a fragment of DNA of a certain length, and the task is to say whether its fragment is coding or non-coding, and if coding, in which frame, in which strand. So that is, this is the problem. And then the approach is very simple. So for instance, if I have a very short fragment, let's say of length 6, n equal 6, then here are possible scenarios. So these are possibilities that I would like to discriminate, predict one of them to be true. So this is XMR representing non-coding region, or it is coding, so it's divided into codons like this, or like this, or like this, right? So this boundary of divisions between codons moves here. Or one more possibility is that it is coding on complementary strand, and boundary between codons is takes three possible positions. Okay, right? So how to discriminate between these options? So if we have models, not this one, which is a aggregated, integrated model, doesn't discriminate between frames, but if you have a model which corresponds to numbers I presented in my tables, then what I can do, I can use them right away here. So I can compute probability of each of these events by using either non-coding set of probabilities or probabilities of presented in the table of positional coding frequencies. I should be careful and start in the right position for right nucleotide, or here, or here. And then I have these products. As well, I have similar products over here when I take numbers from coding region shadow table. So here I have 7 probabilities. And as Michael Gripskov mentioned yesterday, if you do such sort of multiplication, you end up with probabilities which don't sum up to 1. And then you have to normalize this. And here is normalization . However, from another point of view, this expression is a particular case of Bayesian a posteriori probability computation, when you consider events, these 7 events that I mentioned, as equally probable. So then you will have equal numbers all around here, which represent a priori probabilities of these events. Yeah, obviously not. Obviously, in this model, I don't have any correlations. But as you remember, I want to go to highest possible Kolbach-Leibler distance. And this model doesn't provide me with highest possible distance. It provides with better than this. But in order to move to better recognition quality, we indeed did take a next step to use Markov models, which describe correlations between adjacent nucleotides. And as a matter of fact, Pierre Baldi, I don't know if you know Pierre, who is in California at Irvine, and he's an author of one of few good books in bioinformatics, asked me recently, he asked me, how actually you did come to the idea about this three periodic Markov models for the, this what I will tell in a second. And it actually was in this way. In our Institute for Molecular Genetics, you have to go to dining room for a really long way, maybe twice as long as here. And I remember in winter when I was walking to this dining room, I thought about this problem. I thought about the problem that how can we do better discrimination and describe it by Markov model, because Markov model has, as you know, final probabilities, right? Set of final probabilities. When you multiply Dyckhoff matrix many, many times, you eventually come, as Steven mentioned, to matrix is all equal columns. Okay? And these columns correspond, let's say, amino acid, A amino acid. They correspond final probabilities for particular Markov model. And what happens in DNA, as you see, you don't have these final probabilities. It depends on position. So the only way you can do it if you use inhomogeneous Markov model, not the ordinary Markov model as in Dyckhoff model, but inhomogeneous, which has several matrices, not just one matrix. It has to have several matrices. So this was the resolution of that problem, because I realized it's not the class of Markov models where we are going to find a solution, class of ordinary Markov models. And three periodic Markov models gave that result. So if you look into this set of frequencies for dinucleotides, when you take a dinucleotide, for instance, frame 1, it's sitting first and second position of a codon, second, third position, third and first position of a codon. Then you see a distribution of frequencies which really shows correlations in their appearance, and then by usual maximum likelihood rules, if you define coefficients of these matrices, then you have three sets of matrices that can be used for computing in a similar manner that I have shown for six nucleotides. So now, let's say I use larger segments, but I have to, again, be careful and clearly say what particular arrangement is done for each segment of the sequence. So n is now whatever it is, some parameter. Then if I use these three periodic Markov models for coding regions along with a simple Markov model for non-coding region, then here is what I have to for, again, probability of a sequence given particular variant of the model. So these are in the direct strand, three possible frames, complementary strand, three possible frames, and non-coding opportunities. So this sequence will be in non-coding. It from non-coding region, it is generated with such a probability. And then we can take a last step and compute the a posteriori probability for the event that we are actually, and this is what I was interested in. So I have a sequence, SN, and I need to define probability this sequence is non-coding or coding, and if coding, with which probabilities it happens. So this algorithm is quite practical in terms that it gives immediately some opportunity to do DNA sequence analysis. Yes.
You need some priors?
Yes. Yeah, the priors in this algorithm, from the point of view of rigorous theory, they are part of the algorithm. From the point of view of practical implementation, the algorithm is quite robust with regard to variation of these priors. So that's we observe. Yes. Now, normally we put, let's say, we started from thinking, okay, it's equal probability of coding and non-coding, and then we divide probability of coding between frames, so equally. So that's one option to choose priors.
One other way of doing this would be to just use the amino acids of my thought model in terms of expressing amino acids. And one of the things about doing that is if there's a 6 periodicity in the nucleotide sequence, sort of a period 2 in terms of the amino acid sequence, and you could sort of use the same type of approach to get that.
Well,
let me
just say that. Here was what is the major criterion, how good your discrimination is, how good, let's say, how accurate model of a coding region you can make. You can use whatever you choose to use. The main thing is to increase Kalbach-Lieber distance, increase relative entropy. This example that I have shown for first-order Markov model wasn't yet the best one. We used second and third and fourth and fifth-order Markov model. And when you talk about fifth-order Markov model, it means that hexanucleotides are involved in frequency computation, hexanucleotides and like decodons. One thing is that you only use codons or only use amino acids, you lose some information. Definitely DNA has all information. You cannot get more information than DNA has. And you can, of course, reduce this information if it helps to reduce noise, like Stephen said, when you do similarity search on a protein level, it makes sense, because if you go to DNA level and do similarity search, it creates more noise than you like.
If you imagine that the nucleotides are under fast exchange for synonymous substitutions and slow exchange for non-synonymous substitutions,
right,
then you wouldn't lose information by doing this. The other thing that I'm wondering about, though, is that from what I understand, the base compositions change as you go from one part of the sequence to another in the encoding region. And it would seem by looking at the nucleotide level, you'd be sensitive to these sort of longer scale variations in amino acid, nucleotide frequency.
Yes, that's quite indeed so. And when we do is, see, I just at the moment was talking about a set of small segments, and if we go to whole genomes, yes, we start to do something else. So let me show what we do when we start to go through the sequence. And here is way to visualize this process. Let me explain this picture, how it, what is going on here. So if you So you should remember just the previous slide where I said we can compute probability of code 1 as code 2 formulas for computation of these values was presented in the previous slide. Now, if I take a sequence fragment, and this length, let's say, about 100, or if I divide it by multiple of 3, I'll say 96. And then I take this fragment and start to move this fragment along the sequence. So this is a sliding window. And sequence presented over there is about 1,800 nucleotide long. And then I will draw graphs for 6 of these guys. So I have to have 6 panels to draw these probabilities. And the 7th one is not important because the total sum is equal to 1, right? So I can easily say what is the last one. So here is such a picture. I have 3 panels for direct strand and 3 panels for complementary strand. This graph, in a sense, shouldn't be continuous. It should be done with dots, because if I move my window with some steps, which will be convenient to do 3 nucleotides or multiple of 3. Here it did take for speed 9 nucleotides. And here is the result shown for using Markov models which have order 5, so hexanucleotide frequencies. So now what happened is that for each window, these values I show in the center of the window, just every one point on the graph. This corresponds to a center of the window which is lying here. So this window is somewhere one and the same for all these panels. Okay? And basically, these pictures, they are obtained if you move this window around. So this will be like this. So you have a window, and you move it. And you just make these graphs by sliding this window from the beginning to the end of the sequence. So here are some extra objects which I have to explain. So for instance, this is the first panel, and in this panel we represent the reading frame, which starts from the very first nucleotide on the sequence. So you start reading triplets from the very first nucleotide on the sequence. So if you start reading triplets this way, you will see some start codon and stop codons. So these ticks correspond to start codons, and these ticks that look down correspond to stop codons. So these are putative genes, or called open reading frames, just by rules of how genes are organized. So you can start from certain start codon and read triplets until the end. Some of them are very short and realistic. Some of them are longer, like this one, and might be a coding region, and so on. So you see number of open reading frames around. And this, what is graph of a posteriori probability, biologists call it coding potential, really gives you some ground to say here is a region which complies with statistical rules how to make a gene. So we have quite high a posteriori probability all around this region, which drops near stop codon and similar here or here or here. So then there comes some sort of engineering, because we combine these things together just by averaging these values within a particular ORF and predict this or that ORF. If the average value is higher than a certain threshold, like 0.5, we say this is what we predict as a gene. And if not, like here, we say it's not a prediction of a gene. So this open reading frame is not good. There are some other useful applications of such graphs, because in some cases, in open reading frames, you see that coding potential all of a sudden drops down, and see the opposite strand. This is the direction, 5 prime, 3 prime, so the gene goes from right to left. And in such case, it's an interesting point for experimentator to check the sequence and see if there was a sequencing error. So some number of nucleotides, not multiple of 3, might be missing or added. And let's see. Here comes some life story, if you wish. The first publication of such results was done in a journal where you see just few English words down there. But the graph is, looks familiar, right? So our publication in 85, at the time when Human Genome Project didn't start yet, I really wasn't sure if this has some value, this whole analysis and all this research direction. And it was quite an uncertainty for some time until in 1990, when I moved to Atlanta and started to work at Georgia Tech. In about 5 months, no, less than, sorry, 2 months, there was a conference. Hilton had conference on genome sequencing and analysis. And I remember I just got my driver license. I jumped into the car and drove 250 miles to this Hilton Head. And this was my first driving experience in the United States. And then I met at Hilton Head conference Fred Blattner, who looked into this graph and he said, oh, this is what I need for E. coli gene prediction. And in a short while, here was a picture from paper in Science. It was the first chunk of E. coli DNA. At that time, it was very long, 100K. And here are genes as annotated by Fred Blattner team in this sequence. So this gene on opposite strand, gene on direct strand. And there is a small place where you see two overlapping genes, where one on direct and another on complementary strand. And at that time, he didn't trust our predictions for 100%, so he put it right here, two overlapping genes. But essentially, this particular segment of a sequence in our analysis is exactly here. So this is how it was predicted by the program. We call it GeneMark. So the larger ORF in our prediction is not a gene. And in about several months, this actually was experimentally confirmed by a group in Pasteur Institute, that expression in this particular segment of DNA comes from the opposite strand. So after that, Fred was convinced that this is a good approach completely. Then we also thought now better about the potential of this method. And here is another result with Ken Rudd from NCBI. We decided to analyze all intergenic regions in E. coli. It was 95. Those were no annotated genes. And we thought there might be some unnoticed genes. And indeed, this was the number of predictions in regions which were annotated as non-coding regions. And basically, many of them were confirmed by analysis of protein sequence similarity made by, together with Eugene Koonin, whom Steven already mentioned here. And also this most confident part of it has a similarity on protein level, not only to bacterial species, but also to higher eukaryotes. So these guys are called ancient conserved regions. So this result was so convincing that we were contacted by Tiger, who was about to finish first complete genome of bacteria. And here is the result of that contact. So we helped Tiger to annotate genes in H. influenza. So here is where genes are. Let's show this illustration. These are just regions of high and low GC content. And this shows a famous Tiger shotgun method. These are the quantities that were assembled together. And the next landmark achievement was sequencing and annotation of first archaeal genome. It was 96. And interesting thing here is that when you look into sequences, you see that genes are indicated above or below this line which represents DNA. It depends on the direct or complementary strand. Some of them are colored, some of them are blank. So those are colored, they predict a certain function, let's say it's transport protein or certain other protein like energy metabolism or something else. But many blank ones represent those for which similarity search doesn't give any hit. So these were predicted just on the basis of the DNA sequence analysis. Okay. So in general, in terms of combination of DNA sequence analysis and protein sequence analysis, for instance, this is an interface of a software package made in Institut Pasteur. So they incorporated GeneMark into integrated system, which shows this bold white lines are regions where you have similarity search, similarity with proteins. And sometimes you have similarity, sometimes you don't, like this, right? And these arrows, they correspond to when you are able to find a ribosomal binding site. So you may think, this strong ribosomal binding site, there might be a gene. So this is another sort of evidence that you may combine with some other methods on the level of expert analysis, or you, as I can tell later, can combine it right into the algorithm, ribosomal binding site information. Okay. And then accuracy of the method is shown over here in terms of sensitivity and specificity. Ralph, I think I will make a break in a few minutes and just come to some logical stop here. Okay, so what sensitivity and specificity are? Just to remind you what we call, let's say this is a certain set of objects. And you have a prediction algorithm which can identify these objects. But there is a larger set, so you sometimes do correct prediction, sometimes not. Right? Sometimes you pick up as right objects, the objects which actually are not right. So here is area of true positive predictions. These are false negatives, and these are false positive, right? And you may have numbers associated with all these types of objects. So now what you call sensitivity is true positives divided by the whole number of objects, which is false negative plus true positive. Or specificity is true positive divided by total number of predictions. False positive. In other words, if somebody tells you I have 90% sensitivity, it means from the 100% of objects he can predict 90. Or if somebody has 70% specificity, it means from every 100 predictions, 70 are correct. So that is the way to think about it. And here we have, if we put threshold, which I mentioned, threshold for average value of coding potential inside particular open reading frame, on this level, then we have for different genomes that we've worked with, these numbers of sensitivity and specificity, which comes down with the result that in average we have, we predict 93 of every 100 genes, and 96 out of our 100 predictions, each 100 are correct. But if you change the threshold, you of course change the balance between sensitivity and specificity. You become more sensitive but less specific. Yes?
In order to calculate these numbers, you have to know what are the false negatives and what are the false positives. So how do you, what is the alternative information that you use for?
In general, this is a good and difficult question because it's about experimentally confirmed data, which are real genes and which are not. So this data should be taken with caution that we, in some cases, don't know for sure if this is a gene or it is not a gene. So there are multiple pieces of evidence, like protein similarity and experimental confirmation of gene expression and some other things. You know, you can see cDNAs, you can get and combine all these different evidences. So what happened is that annotation teams who, for instance, in December, a Pseudomonas aeruginosa bacterial genome was published in Nature, not the whole genome, but report about it, and it's 6 megabytes of signal, 6,000 genes. If you look into annotation, you will find in about 20% of cases that these genes are putative, hypothetic, possible, probable, all sorts of these things you may find. And in general, you may be very accurate and exclude all these genes from your test set. Still, our figures will be close to these numbers. But we still don't know precisely in case when we have some extra predictions, whether these predictions, a certain fraction of it, is maybe true genes. We just put them into false positives. We don't know. So this is a good question, but we answer this question with some degree of uncertainty. Yes, ma'am. This could, the answer is possibly, I don't know exact answer. My answer is that I think the domains, some of them, are relatively, I'd say, relatively small. And if you go with this assumption, then when you use gene finding, like this brute force, you go through long DNA sequences, this effect might be averaged. So it still produces you with good result, regardless of some deviations in short fragments of DNA, where you may have like polypraline segments or some variations. Hmm? No, I would definitely agree, it would be great. Even when you predict protein domains from pure protein sequence, it is a challenging problem. So I was under impression that there is a big team of people who are working on that, and if I would already solve this in addition to what we do, gene finding, then they won't be happy. And but the actual reason is that it is a challenging problem by itself to predict protein domains, predict protein folding eventually, and all these sort of things. I cannot really do everything at once, but although I think it's within reach, indeed. There is another aspect of what you said, and this aspect is that indeed the language is not always the same, and it is actually next slide in my presentation. Here is what can be considered as different languages. But these are on a different sort of clustering. I don't cluster against domains in protein, but I cluster genes as a whole within a genome, and some of them have different type of codon usage pattern than genes that sort of strongly deviate from this pattern, called atypical genes. And here are numbers in terms of Kalbach-Leibler distance. So there are possibilities that you use this as a general gene model, or this as a general gene model, or this average as a general gene model. And these possibilities are not equal. And I think this is an interesting question, which I will be glad to address after the break. Yes?
You told us about protein genes. What about the RNA genes? I mean ribozymes, ribosomal RNA, and so on. Are they taken, annotated as coding regions, or non-coding regions in your method?
Non-coding regions.
So you are speaking about genes in a very specific sense.
Absolutely, yes. And I mentioned in the very beginning that I'm talking about them.
How do you find genes which are inside, completely inside another gene, but on the opposite strand?
There is no any one observation that such a gene exists, except in phages, but in largest genomes. I'm not aware of any one reliable experimental result. They may overlap to some extent, but completely overlapping genes, I don't know.
Should we then have like a 10-minute break and then continue?
Yeah.
I ask you a little question.
You know, I almost lost my voice. Let me just. Yeah.
Okay.
So, thank you.
А эти люди, которые публикуют вот эти карты?
Let me introduce Stas Bulliev.
This is our first one of these.
Болдырев, правда? Алексей Финкенштейн.
Пойдемте кофейте.
Is your microphone still on?
I'm sorry?
Is your microphone still on?
That could be. I don't notice it. It doesn't. It's just a microphone. Yeah. As far as I can tell, there are just edges. Probably. Еще бактерия на архе. All I can say. Because. For this and this. Actually, two groups. Low eukaryotes have very few introns, like yeast. And phages, they are very dense, very overlapping genes. It's not a microphone, it's just something else. They were looking for microphone. It's just tape recording, so be careful.
Okay, here is my question. You have the sequence left. It's ATG, 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 and TAA, and whatever you want. Well, is a gene? Alpha 1, alpha 2, or alpha 3? And how do you know?
Only cell would know.
So you wouldn't know?
I would predict one of them.
How?
By my method. By this statistical method.
By the statistical method, you can distinguish between the three by using the log likelihood?
Yeah, but with some more general form which I described.
Okay, but so you say you can predict which one?
I will describe how to do this. Can I have one request? If you would do me a favor, come closer because I cannot talk loud. Yes. Please take seats closer.
Sorry, I was maybe sleeping or something. Can you just repeat
first section?
Maybe 1 or 2 minutes to summarize the idea of this your method. So you start with.
I'm sorry, I cannot do this. I can do it for you later on. Just wouldn't be fair to other people who didn't sleep. Okay, so I'm sorry, I now will be really brief because I was asked by organizers to give you some time for lunch before the next session, and so I so if you would like to know more about different languages, you're welcome to go to our website and so this is Dixie old south of Atlanta is center of bioinformatics in Dixie. And Dixie Biology, Georgia Tech edu/GeneMark. And also my web page is connected to our ITP major page. So through my name, you click and go to the page.
This the whole statistical analysis is based upon sort of a model of, you know, the statistics from the non-coding regions or kind of things like that. I'm just wondering, if you were to just look at the regions which you're identifying pretty sure as non-coding regions, how well does it fit that model in terms of the distributions of scores that you get and things like that? I mean, is it a sort of a nice random process, or is it, or are there all sorts of correlations and other things like that that crop up?
Well, let me you see what happened. I should make a big difference between what Stephen was talking about here and I'm talking about here. Stephen, when he talked about distribution for random hits, right? Extreme value distribution. So this extreme value distribution is something like a distribution of scores in non-coding regions, right? And Stephen was talking about some scores which would appear, as a matter of fact, they appear somewhere over here. And these are statistically significant scores which BLAST is taking into account and start to, people start to investigate what is going on. And particularly when database grows, this comes right here, so they have difficult time to do what positive scores, how they can distinguish them from noise, right?
Well, why does that happen?
When database grows,
yeah,
you simply have more hits, random hits with higher scores. It's a factor NN,
yeah.
Right? So, I didn't finish. Let me just say. So, for the sake of getting out of this trouble, they suggested CyBLAST. And CyBLAST is the way that you actually use sort of inhomogeneous model as well, positionally dependent model, like we've used positionally dependent model. So, instead of just one prime matrix, which gives you for each position 400 scores, but they are all one and the same when you go along the sequence. What you do, you take in each position different prime matrix in the CyBLAST, which correspond to situation. Here is, for instance, prime 250, this is 80. This is 80, which corresponds to more conservative region over here. And as you know, in protein sequences, they vary in their conservation degree. So this is very convenient method, which allows you, let's say this is a family of proteins. If you know just one and try to use standard BLAST, you may get to nowhere because you are in here. But if you take several more and build profile CyBLAST, which is equivalent to this position dependence, then you have sort of magnifying glass, which allows you to remove these distributions from each other on a larger distance. So I understand your question. So how our distribution of scores in non-coding regions look like, because we also deal with the Kalbach-Leibler distance. And what Steve is, Altschulte is doing, he also doing with such scores on diagonals. When you go on diagonals, you come to log likelihood as well. And you have the scores where you have essentially two models, one model here, another model here, and this model corresponds to pairs. Just only generalization is that it corresponds to sequence of pairs. Either they are evolutionary related or they are not evolutionary related. And on these diagonals you have somewhere some clamps of positive scores, so you can get to the points over here. But in his case, as you know, sum Sij Pi Pj is less than zero. Right? But this was a condition. In our case, we don't have this condition. So we really want to make it as large as possible because it's an entirely different problem. And we don't have such an extreme value distribution and things like that.
But I'm just wondering, in terms of, for instance, you have a sum of px log, px1 log px2 or px1 log px1, you know, divided by n or whatever, that you would still expect to see a well-characterized distribution of whatever probability, whatever score is, however you want.
Well, they are well, you know, divided from each other. Coding region, non-coding region. Non-coding region is really separate.
Right, but what I'm wondering is, if you look at that curve mm-hmm. on the non-coding region, is it the shape and width and things like that you would expect? Or is that curve on the left anomalous?
Oh, the one thing we are concerned about intersection, the subtle features of that distribution. Probably we did study sometime, but we didn't find anything interesting. So we care about accuracy of prediction. Okay.
I'm not sure whether I got the point there on the comparison to the usual last kind of thing. Are you saying that you don't need this condition on the average because
In gene finding, no.
Yeah, why? I mean, why would you...
It's an entirely different problem. Gene finding is not same class of a problem, I would say. We
emphasize that you also want to see those local regions of significance.
No, it's not, and this is a long discussion. I will let us postpone it. It's just, let me say it's not. It's not the same type of tool. Let me go ahead and ask you. Because the next thing which I wanted to say, I actually wanted to get rid of sliding window. I think that sliding window has advantages and disadvantages. And disadvantage is that you cannot exactly say about the boundary of your gene. Okay? So when you move your window, the assumption is the sequence in the window is homogeneous. It's either coding region or non-coding region. Now, if I move to more detailed way to analyze sequences, I can think about hidden functional states. So what is, you don't see, you see sequence, you don't see functional states, which might be, for instance, this part is non-coding, direct coding, non-coding, reverse coding. Okay? Or any other arrangements of letters N, D, R in this sequence. So you have 3 power N possibilities. But idea is that one of these sequences correspond to actual meaning, functional meaning of DNA. And let's say this one is a real one. So how to find a way to extract this real sequence out of possibilities that we have? And let's say one simple model is hidden Markov model, which says I have hidden state N, I have hidden state D and R. There are transitions, and there are transitions which repeat one in the same state, and also each state can emit nucleotides which we observe. So bases, so B, the difference is their probabilities are different. Okay, this is D, this is N. So distributions are different. The idea is, if you observe this sequence, you can assign probability measure to each particular sequence like that, and you can find one with maximum probability and say this is the sequence which explains my observed sequence. So generally we use such a model. It's simplified, with one important difference, that we allow in each hidden state emit not only one nucleotide, but a whole segment of DNA sequence. So-called hidden Markov model with duration. So you emit a segment. So this is B1, BL, and these values LD, LN, L, okay, LR, they have their own distributions of lengths. So these are some distributions. Here I have to skip a section about classical hidden Markov models with regard to how find a sequence of hidden states that allows you to maximize probability of observable sequence. The method how to find it is dynamic programming algorithm called Viterbi algorithm. So because of lack of time, I have to skip this standard section. It's just something that you can take a look in the book of Durbin and others, statistical analysis of biological sequences. It was cited by Michael yesterday. So this is a concise and very good explanation of this dynamic programming method, which essentially allows you to find this trajectory through hidden states. So here's a duration. So in one state, you have emitted sequence of this length, another length, another length. So this is what you maximize, probability of observed sequence with regard to possible hidden states. And here's a brief description of the algorithm which we leave behind. Here is a more detailed diagram of these states, when I also make this distinction between atypical and typical models of coding regions on both strands. And here are a hidden state diagram, yes. And here are these length distributions for coding regions and non-coding regions, so that what we get.
Can you ask a question?
Yes.
Monitoring distributions, the fact that it is very much away from the exponential at very small lengths, is that real? Is that statistical deviation at small lengths?
Are they, you mean they're similar or dissimilar?
Dissimilar at small lengths.
I think it is significant, yeah.
There are more than
I think. Yeah. Okay, and let's see. I can show. Let's see, what is it? Here this is our preliminary results on this algorithm. Preliminary results. So we were trying to increase the number of exact predictions, so to precisely predict gene starts in prokaryotes. And eventually what we used experimentally verified set of E. coli genes with experimental procedure called protein sequencing. So you sequence N terminals. This work was done by Andy Link at Harvard. So they have a collection of just about 200 genes. And when we analyzed predictions with regard to experimental notation, so this is what we get as a result. At the beginning, a gene start. It's easier to predict stops. And if you see, I didn't make it. When we talk about only stops, then let's see. Now, this would be missing genes here, where you don't predict stops. So the percentage is very small. It's 99.5. It's good in prediction of the whole gene, but may misplace a start codon. So it is all predicted, almost all of them, but in 12% cases misplaced start code.
What is VNA and what is
VNA? Oh, Viterbi algorithm. And this is post-processing when you, in addition to the Viterbi algorithm, which finds the optimal trajectory, you can use post-processing with using extra information about ribosomal binding site. At a certain stage, as a preliminary result, it was extra step of the algorithm. But now it's inside the algorithm. And actually, the how serious the problem is with predicting starts in prokaryotic genomes is that some of them have genes annotated as longest possible ORFs. So you go to the leftmost ATG and say, here is my gene. And this what is done, for instance, Seneca Sister's genome is 0% of any other ATGs. And let's say you have that many genes, only one annotated as not leftmost, so on. So then, although the expected number of such genes is between 20 and 25%, so I am certain that in here, in that number of sequenced bacterial genomes, there are many with starts misplaced. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's what we want to figure out, how nature makes it. And there is a signal which I showed, a ribosomal binding site, which may be located close to real star. And yes, there is a combination of two factors. One factor is you have several possible ATGs, right? So here you have a sequence which goes into coding region according to good a posteriori probability. So if you put the signal here, it may look like this. So you already may have some idea that this is probably right, or maybe this. So in between these three, you have to choose. And in addition, you may have a ribosomal binding site signal, which may be better for this one and not for this, in all possible combinations. So program makes some decision based on combination of these things. So we were trying to further improve this in addition to what I said, and included a whole procedure of that sort into self-training algorithm. So we have now a self-training program which can start from completely anonymous genome. There is a certain procedure how to determine parameters for the model, which I can give you a reference, our paper in nucleic acid research. So you don't have to do much of training. You can find out parameters from some heuristic procedure. Then you find coding regions, first approximation, and then build all necessary models from this first approximation, and then go into cycles to come to convergence. So the regions which you would predict will correspond to, after training, to new predictions. So as soon as you get to the situation when your prediction don't change, you say this is the result. So this program is now out there on our website. So and this works a little bit better than one I presented. So it finds 95% of 95.9% of this experimentally validated starts. And So very briefly, I will tell you about generalization of this model for the case of eukaryotic genomes. So when you have such a complicated situation, so what you can do, and picture for hidden Markov model essentially look like this, because you have to deal with all connections between exons, so you don't have to violate the open reading frame, and you may have still both sides of DNA double helix. So this diagram also is combined with the length distributions. For instance, this is length distributions for different eukaryotic species. And this shows actually three periodicity, some sense in the length. And there are also length distributions for introns like this, so different species. And these are not exponential like in non-coding regions. So look at this. That's rice. I need to check. I think it is exponential. I have to double check. So essentially, when this is a diagram similar to I have shown, the diagram which will lead you through hidden states. So it's not complete diagram, but it shows the different possible passes. This is in red, for instance. It's a possible pass through the hidden states, which, let's say, for illustration, I said it is an optimal one. But in each position, this is stop, SP is stop, this is start. So initial exon can last from start to donor side. Right? Terminal exon can go from acceptor to stop, acceptor to stop. Or exon can go between acceptor and donor sides. And actually, vice versa. Intron, acceptor and donor side, that's correct, yes. Intron goes from donor to acceptor side, yes. Donor acceptor side. These ones?
Blue or gray,
okay. These are possible changes from one hidden state to another, but these are not optimal if you compute the whole function. These are possible ways to go. So you have a big graph, you have to optimize functional on the graph. So for biologists, actually it looks like this. So what you see is that coding potential correlates well with the predictions of switching between hidden states, and these switches indicate your boundaries of introns and exons, intergenic regions. And sometimes it produces quite a, say, dramatic examples. For instance, you can predict genes with many exons with quite a little inaccuracy. Or this gene, it's humans, or this. Or sometimes you can predict very short exons. One of them is three nucleotides. So here is the result for Arabidopsis accuracy testing by a group at University of Ghent in Belgium. So they collected specifically reliable test set, and this program for eukaryotes called gene, actually for prokaryotes as well, but in hidden Markov models framework called GeneMark HMN. So here they found quite a good result for this program in comparison with other very good programs, as a matter of fact, which also exist in other universities and research labs. So we have it with exons exactly predicted both ends for real exons. So they were found 82 out of 100 exactly, and out of our 100 predictions of exons, 77 were exactly correct. So these are figures in this comparison the highest. So the program was indeed intensively used for annotation of Arachidopsis genome.
How is the true answer known?
They had a set of sequences verified with mRNAs. So they believed this is the...
What's the program being trained on?
This program was trained on data available in GeneBank, and we just take what is available in GeneBank. It's all we can.
There's nothing specific to this
particular. No. Other programs were trained the same way.
And why did the other programs do so bad? Like, say, FEX. What was the good one, the good one from the bad ones?
No, these are parameters which I said. For instance, this program makes 55 findings of every 100 exons, and it's, which is also was good quite 2 years ago. It was not bad. Yeah. And this, out of 100 predictions, 32 are correct. So why this program doesn't do well, how to improve it, it's a whole research project.
Is it the same kind of methodology as GeneMark, or is it something different?
It's different. It's different. These programs use neural networks, F-Gene and F-TX, using discriminant analysis. MZF is also using discriminant analysis. This is using hidden Markov models. Yeah. But I agree, so it's, in general, yes, we still are working with this question. And this is all. Thank you.